Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. According to the nonprofit Population Reference Bureau, the number of Americans aged 65 and older is projected to more than double to more than 98 million by 2060. We're seeing the effects of this population shift now as the supply of caregivers struggles to keep up with demand. One possible part of the solution is to outsource part of that care to virtual caregivers. Tech journalist Lauren Smiley recently wrote about tech and elder care for Wired. We'll have a link to her story on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Lauren Smiley joins us now by phone. Welcome back, Lauren.
Thanks so much for having me again, Ann.
You profiled a family struggling to care for their elderly father who has Alzheimer's. Tell us a little bit about that story and what led them to seek out this high-tech help we're going to talk about.
Yeah, so I focused on this family in Minnesota where it was, you know, a woman in her 50s, an adult daughter who had been, you know, straining to take care of her dad, who is now in his 90s with pretty advanced Alzheimer's. He had been very, you know, stubborn about wanting to stay at home, not wanting to go into a, you know, a senior care center. And so she had just seen an advertisement in the newspaper for this product from a startup here in Silicon Valley called Care.Coach. And she wanted to try it immediately to see if it could help her keep her dad at home for a little bit longer. So the product itself is it appears to be a animal avatar on a tablet screen. So you look at it and it seems like you're looking at a cartoon dog or cat, basically, and it will talk to you in sort of a robotic voice. It's not a human voice. And it will sort of chat, you know, socially with you about any topic you wish to talk about. And it also can kind of keep you on track with, you know, your medication reminders or ask you medical questions throughout the day to make sure you're doing all right. But the major twist of this avatar is that, you know, artificial intelligence, you know, the Alexas that are talking to us in our home, I think we all know, are not advanced enough at this point to be having just freewheeling conversations with us mm-hmm. about any topic under the sun. So they have had to staff this for now with our current technology. They staff it with, you know, remote contractors that are actually overseas in the Philippines and in Mexico. They are humans who are actually, you know, watching the humor, watching the senior in their home through the tablet's camera and listening to them through the tablet's microphone and then, you know, typing the responses into this system that then, you know, speaks what they have typed, you know, in this robotic voice to the senior. So you are actually talking to a human on the other end. It's just there's this interface of a pet between you.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest, Lauren Smiley, tech journalist for Wired. We're talking about a story she recently wrote about virtual pets, not powered by artificial intelligence, as she just described, but by humans far, far away. And they're being used to help out, monitor, and be companions to elderly Americans. The service is called Care.Coach, right? It comes with a tablet that shows the animated pet. Can you give us some examples, Lauren Smiley, of how Care Coach helps out during the day? What, besides just chatting with the client or the person, what else do they do?
Yeah, so there is a sort of an entire like back end system of this software where a social worker or the person's doctor can put specific instructions in there, speaking to this contractor about, like, please ask this person at noon every day if they have taken their meds, if they have drink water this morning, how they're feeling, how are their feet today, how are they feeling, whatever is, you know, the specific problem that this person has. You know, there's several different regimens, health regimens it can follow throughout the day to care for different types of, you know, problems. And I did go actually here in San Francisco and meet with a woman who had several health problems in her house and just watch her interact with it throughout the day. And it would pipe up throughout the day and just kind of check in, make sure she's doing okay, and ask her sort of a series of questions at specific times throughout the day just to make sure she was all on track. And this is all a pet, of course.
Yeah, well, the fellow that you profiled, the family, he didn't see it. He is Alzheimer's was advanced enough. He did not relate to it as anything but a little pet avatar. He would pet it, and little hearts would pop from it, little animated hearts and that kind of a thing. But he did not. Mm-hmm. He thought it really knew him and, didn't see that it was a toy.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that caused a slight, ethical concern on the part of the family. They did make the decision not to tell him that there were humans on the other end of this because mm-hmm. they just decided his Alzheimer's was advanced enough that he wasn't asking about it anymore. Mm-hmm. Therefore, why confuse him with these details? He's not really going to be able to grasp. But honestly, I mean, this is not just used with people with dementia. Mm-hmm. It's all over the board. And so there's many people out there who are using this that are well aware that there is a human on the other end of this watching them and talking to them. But one, just fascinating part of this while reporting is just how quickly people are they intellectually understand that, but they just accept this on its face value after a certain while. Like, this is just a pet that talks to me on my tablet. They kind of stop caring exactly what's making it, go. Stop really caring about the human on the other end and just kind of accepted it at face value. And that was also the case of the adult daughter who was taking care of this man in Minnesota that I focused on. She herself bonded with this pet avatar.
Right. The person behind the avatar was somebody who lived in Mexico, right?
Yeah. So there's a series, since this, this avatar is available 24/7, that's part of the, mm-hmm. the good thing about this service is it can keep an eye on you in your house, like, all the time. But part of that is that they do have, a rotating sort of cast of workers that will be working on any 24-hour given period. But one of the main people that had taken care of this man in Minnesota that I focused on, he was in Monterrey, Mexico. And so I did talk to him. The company put me in touch with two of their workers, one in the Philippines and one in Mexico. And I was able to interview them at length about this very unusual job they have.
Yeah, you talked a little bit with them about the bonding of this, that they bonded emotionally with their patients.
Yeah. This is kind of the first question that a lot of people ask when the CEO of this company is going to hospitals and senior care centers around the country, pitching his product. People always ask, who are the people on the other end? You would really have to trust whoever these people are that they wouldn't,
the little doggy wouldn't say, go give me your bank account number.
Exactly.
Right.
That's exactly what my mother said when I told her about this. So they do vet them very heavily. They told me they only hire about 1 out of 100 applicants, and they run them through like HIPAA training, privacy mm-hmm. law around medicine in the United States. They have to take sort of an Alzheimer's caretaking curriculum. They do like a lot of training and onboarding to be able to do this. And I talked to these, two people, and they just seemed like incredibly sweet people.
Well,
honestly.
I'm sure they
and
gave you a couple of stars, but
right,
be that as it
I think
may,
they
yeah.
gave me their stars.
yeah. How you mentioned you made a passing reference to for now that artificial intelligence is going forward, kind of what they're shooting for then?
Yeah. So, them being part of, technologists here in Silicon Valley, they are interested in how much of, especially the rote question asking, like things that must be asked at noon every day. Did you drink water today? How are you feeling? Things that are the same. They're interested in turning that into software that cues the avatar to ask those things. And then, of course, the human, we're still a long way out from, you know, a robot being able to just talk to you about whatever like a human could. So reserve the human conversation skills for those more social chats, mm-hmm. and make them more medical driven, you know, questioning throughout the day. Make that just software that queues up.
So what are your Black Mirror concerns about this technology after reporting on it? What could go awry?
So, I mean, there were several things. So one researcher I talked to who had run a study with this up in Seattle, he's at the University of Washington, he saw that there was a bit of separation anxiety for some people. They got like very bonded with these avatars. And by the end of the study, you know, one woman in his study just did not want to say goodbye to this new friend who had been in her house talking to her for weeks. And so she ended up just keeping the service on and paying for it out of pocket after the study in order to keep it with her. And so there was a slight concern. I mean, all these studies are very, very new, mm-hmm. like, you know, preliminary pilot studies. These are not, you know, large scale studies by any means. But that was one thing they brought up. Some people, I mean, you do, the name of the game here is that there is a remote person watching you in your house. So you just have to be okay with that. And that's probably going to be a growing concern, you know, as more seniors stay in their homes and without family nearby to take care of them, is how much are we going to be okay with people monitoring our parents in their homes? Mm-hmm. And then there's a slight ethical concern of, do you tell a parent with, you know, some sort of dementia, whether there's a human on the other end of it or not? The avatar does follow a script when it queues up, say, in hospitals. They do use this in some inpatient units at mm-hmm. different hospitals around the country. And when it queues up, it will say, "Hi, I am an avatar powered by a team of professionals." That's how it introduces itself. Mm. So it does make reference. And then, you know, the hospital staff I talked to says that they do say, you know, that there's a human on the other end of this. I mean, how much seniors in a hospital, you know, are actually grasping of all this is, you know, another thing. But, and then I'll just add one more thing.
Sure.
The bigger moral issue here that I, you know, ran into two camps of thought here is just how much do we want technology stepping in the first place to take care of seniors? This kind of is an unsettling prospect for a lot of people to, you know, the thought of hoisting off care onto a tablet or onto a pet avatar instead of a human being there in the house. And I talked to, you know, most notably, Sherry Turkle at MIT. She's the author of Alone Together. Mm-hmm. You know, she's a critic of, you know, having too many of human roles in our society being taken over by technology.
Right.
And she was rather skeptical of this entire proposition. But then, you know, a much larger group of technologists are just saying, just demographically, it's just inevitable that this is an aging country and there's just not enough young people available to take care of the ballooning population of seniors. And so technology is going to have to step in to a certain degree to be able to keep people in their homes and functioning.
You mentioned earlier that it is a long way off before AI, artificial intelligence, can pick up the slack. That said, what is the capacity of Care.coach? I mean, how many people can they serve?
I think they can ramp up. Right now, it is a small startup. It's getting off the ground. It is in, I would say, maybe a half dozen hospitals, inpatient units around the country, in all parts of the country. It's not just here on the West Coast. They mm-hmm. have a hospital in South Carolina. You know, this user was in Minneapolis, and I think in New York City, in Queens, there's a hospital that is using this in an inpatient unit. And then the senior care centers have been signing up for this. So they've been going after sort of larger, you know, hospitals and senior care centers that are going to be serving many seniors at a time. But then, you know, private families can buy this, you know, mm-hmm. pay for this service out of pocket. It's about $200 a month.
Lauren Smiley, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Lauren Smiley's tech journalist for Wired. She recently wrote about tech and elder care. We'll have a link to her story on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. Coming up, more Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. 3D printing has been around for years. It's been a frequent topic on Tech Tuesday. Most think of 3D printers as using plastics to build things, but recent advances in 3D printing metal could mean big things for the world of manufacturing. And that's just one of the innovations highlighted in this month's issue of the MIT Technology Review as the top breakthrough technologies of 2018. Joining us now is the editor of the MIT Technology Review, David Rotman. Welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Listeners, to see a full list, visit the link at our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. So the 3D metal printing, what are the major advances that we're seeing in that? What's catapulted it to the world of possibility?
Well, as you said, 3D printing of plastics has been possible for a while. And it's been possible to 3D print metal parts, but it's been very, very expensive and very slow to do. And what's new here is that there's new printers, 3D printers, that can make metal parts pretty quickly, and these machines are much cheaper. One machine is for less than $100,000. So you can begin, it begins to make it much more practical for many more people.
I can see where this could replace unusual parts to a machine much quicker than having to order out to some other, an engineering firm to design it, blah, blah, blah. You could just have those kind of things on hand then?
That's right. Or you can imagine instead of having to have a large inventory of parts for, say, the older cars or older tractors or older machines, instead of trying to have a large inventory, you can just print out the part that a person needs.
What kind of metal is it? Is it the right kind of metal, or is it any kind of metal that you can use in these machines now?
It's not quite any type of metal, but it's a wide range of metals from stainless steel to titanium. So many of the most commonly used metals it's possible to use.
And what industries, where are you seeing this having the biggest impact?
So this is just coming on. These machines are just available. The first generation, which I said were quite expensive and quite slow, were used to make highly high-valued parts for jet engines. And so they're already been used in jet engines. But now with the machines cheaper, it's going to be accessible to a much broader range of applications.
Another topic, another issue, smart cities here in Columbus. The city is working on implementing its plans for a smart city grant. MIT Technology Review highlighted what's happening in Toronto. Tell us about it.
So smart cities, the idea of making a high-tech smart city has been around for a long time, and they're not always been very successful. So what we wrote about was a project in Toronto that is being led by Alphabet, Google's company called Sidewalk Labs. And the idea is to automate cars, to have self-driving cars, to have robots that will roam around doing menial tasks like picking up the garbage or delivering the mail. And there will be sensors everywhere that will monitor people's activities and where people are coming and going, and just a real high-tech neighborhood full of sensors and automated vehicles. One interesting thing about this is that they're trying to work quite closely with the community to make sure that privacy concerns are taken care of and so on.
Well, how so? I mean,
so people, their activities will be monitored very closely. There'll be sensors everywhere.
Yeah.
So it raises the question of privacy and
right.
Really want to be monitored. So the companies are working with the city government in Toronto and also the neighborhood groups to really ask them, you know, what's appropriate, what do you feel comfortable with, and try to come to that agreement before they push ahead with implementing the technology.
When you talk about, can you give us some examples of what types of data is going to, you know, could be collected by this network of sensors?
For example, as I said, it will monitor people's activity, so they'll know that you're ready for, you want to go home from the store, and that it's ready for a car to pick, a self-driving car to pick you up and bring you home. Or one can imagine automating the delivery of mail or services such as the pickup of garbage and knowing when it's time to do such things.
What's all this going to look like in 10 or 20 years? What kind of, you know, what do they show you? What kind of pictures? How are you going to describe it?
I mean, the vision is a very sort of a high-tech city with self-driving vehicles and robots roaming about. I don't know if that's exactly what it will look like. I think we'll see. What I think is important is that cities themselves are not very smart right now. They're chaotic. There's traffic. They're inefficient. And so I do think there's a lot of room to make them much more efficient, much more clean, much more sustainable neighborhoods.
Another topic, consumer-grade artificial intelligence. You know, every major tech company is working on artificial intelligence projects, and almost all of them are working on making it more accessible with cloud-based AI. What's going on?
So we think AI is really, it will be really important, will really change businesses and how we live. But so far, it's been very much sort of restricted to the big companies that have dominated AI. It's still very hard to do. It means you need a lot of talent, a lot of expertise to do it. So what we feel is important is that there's an increasing effort to put these AI tools, machine learning tools, in the cloud and make them much more accessible to businesses and to individuals eventually. So the effort is to put it into the cloud, and then people can develop apps or any other type of software that can utilize these advanced AI techniques.
Can you give me an example of how a smaller company might put that technology to use?
So, for example, you want to know who's looking at your website and where they're coming from and maybe where they're going. And so you have all that data, and AI can really make sense out of that data.
Speaking of AI, there's work being done to give AI a better imagination. Tell us about Generative Adversarial Network, or GAN.
So GAN is a new technique, but it's quite a breakthrough in AI. So the newest types of AI are quite good at recognizing images. So if you give them enough data about what a cat looks like, and then you show it a cat, it can recognize it as a cat. So it's become quite good at recognizing images. But what it's not good at is recognizing things it hasn't seen before. So, a cat on a bicycle, it's never seen, and that would be very confusing. So this new technique allows it to imagine things that it has not seen before. It imagines a cat in an unusual situation and still knows that it's a cat. So in a sense, it has the imagination because it's identifying things, or it can create visions or pictures of things that it has never seen before, but that are based on reality and based on what it knows.
Some people think this sounds sort of scary. Is there a reason for concern? Is there a downside here?
I think we'll see what the imagination of AI leads to. So far, I think it's early. I think there's not a really reason to be scared, but it is a potentially very powerful technique, and you begin to think about AI imagining different scenarios, imagining different visions, and who knows where that leads to.
Real-time language translation in our ears, that sounds like something that could be useful right away.
Yes, so this is ready out there. It's a product by Google. It's called Pixel Buds. And I think it's really very interesting.
How does real-time, it work? Yeah.
Yeah, real-time translation is already available, as we know, and it's getting much, much better. Google Translation is translating, I'm not sure how many languages, but it's more than 50 languages right now, and it's getting very accurate. But this these earbuds make it much easier to talk to another person. So one person wears the earbuds, another person has a smartphone, and they can talk to each other in two different languages. And the translation is sort of seamless, and the conversation between two people sort of looking at each other and just going back and forth naturally in a conversation in two different languages.
Where is it being used now?
These are available. You can, for $159, you can buy a pair of these. And I think there are 30 languages that can translate back and forth. So anyone can use them.
The person who reviewed it for MIT Technology Review said that the Pixel Buds were widely panned for subpar design. They said they look silly. What's I'm not sure why I think they – I'm not sure – sure, they look silly. Why do they say that?
Well, I think the design, and Google sort of admits that the design is not yet optimal. They're maybe don't fit properly into the air, and the design could be improved. But we feel the underlying technology, which is the ability to do real-time translation, is very powerful and is really amazing. So the design itself will get much better. And we'll get ones that are much more comfortable and much more stylish.
It sounds like it'd be great for somebody who's traveling.
I think it'll be amazing. I mean, it will allow you to have a conversation with someone that speaks an entirely different language.
But they have to have them, too.
Or they have to have a smartphone with the app. Yes.
Another topic, perfect online privacy. That sounds like a pipe dream. I mean, it's like every other show on Tech Tuesday has something to do with privacy, online privacy, and the lack thereof.
Yes. So this is an issue that troubles us all, as you just mentioned. This is a tool that was developed for using blockchain, which is the underlying technology for Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. And they have been able to develop a tool using blockchain that allows you just to give the relevant information to the other party if you're for example, in a financial transaction. So you just are able to give them the pertinent information. Say, I have $100 in the bank, and that's all you need to give them. You don't need to identify how much money you have in the bank, what bank it is, or anything else, just the relevant information. So it protects you from identity theft, or it just protects your privacy.
How do they do this? It's called zero knowledge proof. How does it work?
I will not even try to explain. I don't think I completely understand how it works.
Okay, but you can. It's a way to transact anonymously, for one thing, right?
That's correct, and it's a way to. But and most importantly, it's a way just to give the relevant information that's needed for the transaction, no more.
And the creator of Ethereum, the second most popular blockchain network, has described one of these for this practical zero knowledge proof as absolute. Game-changing technology.
That's right. That's what we quote him as saying.
Yeah.
Just to that, absolutely game-changing technology. Because if for the first time you don't want to give all this information. You want to make a transaction online. You want to deal with different things in the internet, but you don't want to reveal all this information that you currently do.
Well, David Rotman, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. We'll have a link to the article from MIT Technology Review on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for joining us, David.
Great. Thank you. My pleasure.
David Rotman, editor of the MIT Technology Review. More Tech Tuesdays coming up with Russell Holley on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When we think of augmented reality, we usually imagine virtual objects being projected into our visual field. But the audio company Bose is taking a different approach, working to augment our ears instead of our eyes. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
I'm just really trying to wrap my brain slash ears around this. How does audio-based augmented reality glasses, how would they work?
Well, so these are sunglasses, basically, the prototypes that are being shown off at South by Southwest this week that have little speakers over by the ears. And they have special sensors in them that can tell what direction you are facing. And so the idea here is that using the GPS on your phone and using the location information in the glasses, when you are pointed in a specific direction and you tap the side of the glasses will use that combination of information to give you data about what's right in front of you. The way that this is being demonstrated is walking down a busy street with a whole bunch of different bars and restaurants. And when you face one of those restaurants and you tap the side of the glasses, you actually hear what's important about that restaurant, what some of their most popular dishes or drinks are, and there's and all that information is just kind of fed into your ear without anything at all happening in front of your eyes.
So I would want to know what the happy hour special is that day.
Right. That's the kind of information that Bose is hoping to work with developers to make available, is to be able to get kind of quick snippets of information, just by kind of looking in the general direction of a business or a place or something. Think about a museum, trip where you're walking through a museum tour, and instead of having the kind of guided audio tape based on how long the tour is supposed to take, you can actually face a particular thing inside of the museum and tap the side of your glasses and get that information, get that part of the tour read to you because the glasses know specifically where you are inside of the museum.
That's pretty cool. What do they look like?
Right now, they're a 3D printed set of glasses. They look very much like normal sunglasses that have slightly chunkier tips that hide behind your ears, and then you can see kind of little speakers. But Bose is making it clear that this is not the actual product. They're working on this technology in the hopes that they can work with other partners, maybe sunglass manufacturers or just normal headphone manufacturers, in order to release consumer products maybe later this year or next year that have this technology built in.
Yeah, I mean, couldn't it just be like earbuds or something? I mean, yeah.
Right. The other thing that they're testing this in is a pair of the Bose QC30 headphones. So they don't have to be eyeglasses. They can really be any shape that's something that you would wear that can deliver sound to you in a way that doesn't interrupt the people around you.
My mind goes wild. I'm thinking about schedules at train stations, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of information could be useful. Really what this comes down to is, Bose needs to be able to work with developers who can access that kind of information and make it useful. And if possible, then this could be just a huge thing, not just for daily use, but also, people with vision problems.
Yeah.
So, this kind of, it could be deeply assistive as well.
Android has a new operating systems coming down the pike. What's been released so far is meant for app developers, though. What are they going to be looking to take advantage of?
This is a big thing that Google does every year, and Apple does the same at different points of the year. This next version of Android is focused on giving you as much information as possible through the notification, instead of making it so that you have to kind of unlock the phone and go to the app and check things. So like your normal notifications right now, if you get someone sends you a picture or something like that, you get a little notification that says, this person sent you a picture. Well, now they're going to make it so that you can, that the picture is actually part of the notification so that you can see it without having to open the application. And you'll be able to reply to that with, either preloaded messages that Google has designed for you or just, normally texting in the notification. But the idea is to make, that kind of instant communication that you have even more efficient. Is a big part of what's coming to this.
I'm trying to figure out why. I mean, when I text somebody a picture, they get the picture. What's different?
Well, the big thing, they get the picture, but they get the picture inside of the application. And this is going to sound very silly, but you get that notification, and then you have to swipe up to open the phone, and then you have to put your fingerprint down to unlock the phone, and then you have to go to the app. The whole idea here is to give you that information without needing to do things like unlock your phone or check and see if the information was useful to you. It's removing the total number of steps to solving a problem, to solving a thing, not necessarily a problem, but.
Well, it's not a problem, but there is a reason why you have to unlock your phone. It's for privacy.
Well, and there are security tools that you can say, I don't want this message showing up on my notifications while my phone is locked. And that's a feature that's been a part of Android and iPhone for a while. But then you have people like me who don't ever turn that on because I get too many messages during the day, either from my kids or from my partner or, something like that. So it's nice to have. And now that I have kids that take selfies constantly and still need to share the best ones with me, I get several pictures, when I'm in the middle of a meeting or something like that. And so being able to kind of glance down and give them a quick thumbs up in response or something like that is a valuable thing. Because in the case of my son, if I don't respond to him right away, he just sends me more. Because clearly I didn't get the notification for the first one, so he needs to keep working to capture my attention.
Oh, boy, that's great. Well, once they start popping up, everyone will see them.
Exactly.
What have the early reviews been like?
So far, it's been a very positive, kind of streamlined experience. It's clear that Google's not making any radical changes as far as how things look, but they are the focus for this next version of Android, which doesn't have like an official name yet. Google always names them after very silly desserts and things like that. But this one doesn't have a dessert name yet. We probably will hear that in May.
God, the names. You wrote that Google wants to make turn-by-turn directions while you are inside just as good as maps when you are outside. Inside what? Inside a building?
Inside of a bunch of different buildings. So think about like large train stations or airports or stadiums. If you want directions to, where the bathroom is in a stadium, that's actually a problem that I have all the time. when I go to any kind of sporting event or something, I can never find a bathroom. And the idea here is this special version of Wi-Fi, the next version of Wi-Fi that will provide location data when you're inside a building. It doesn't rely on GPS, which can be very flawed when you're inside of a building. So this uses a new kind of technology that would make it so that you can actually get turn-by-turn directions when you're inside of a crowded building and have it be accurate, have it be just as accurate as turn-by-turn navigations when you're walking down the street or when you're driving. So you can be inside of a mall or a museum or a stadium or something like that and have, turn left at this intersection here, to get where it is that you want to go.
I could see that being very helpful when you're traveling in big airports.
Airports are a big one. Mm-hmm. There are a couple different, really just any large building that you're not in all the time. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. If you want to find a particular store inside of a mall or something like that, there's definitely some useful applications. And this is going to be something that Google's going to work on to have available in a couple of places by the end of the year. But it probably won't be until this time next year that we start seeing it roll out to a lot of different places, because it's going to require businesses to install some new technology.
Yeah.
In order for it to really work. But when it does work, it should be very cool.
And it as far as the updates to everybody's phone, it'll be through updates, right?
This will be available through software updates. And then, this is something that we won't see on phones unless you're a nerd like me and install it yourself. This is something that won't be available through an update on a phone until much closer to the end of the year. Probably August or September is typically when Google releases these to the public. And it will also be available on, whatever Google's next Pixel phone will be towards the end of the year. And that's the whole idea here, is kind of preparing developers for those new experiences.
And did we already talk about Android's improvements to privacy?
Well, we didn't. Android's improvements to privacy here, they're all about, protecting the different kinds of information that you're storing for things like backups. Backups are encrypted end-to-end, and there are some new security tools for keeping your phone, making it impossible for any application to to do things like access your camera or your microphone or your speakers, anything like that, when those apps are in the background. So there are some apps that it's beneficial to have running in the background and doing things. And you have the ability to remove certain permissions if you choose to. So you can say, I don't want that app to have microphone access, the tool that you have right now. But Google's making it so that it's just a flat line impossible for any application to have access to your microphone or your camera when that app is running in the background. So unless you have the app open on your phone, it can't access the phone or the microphone or the camera to do anything without your permission.
Is that something that you see other phones coming up with too? Other like Apple? I mean, I like that idea. It seems like a lot of people would.
I think it's becoming more necessary given the way that people use their phones, because you kind of have to think about it like the terms of service, set up for things. You know, everyone just kind of ignores the terms of service. Well, permissions on a phone is the same way. Everyone has the ability to go in and say, no, I don't want this app to have this data. I don't want this app to have this data. But very few people actually use that information. And when you get little notifications on your phone that says, you know, that this app wants to use the camera, a lot of people just automatically click it and go.
The let's get to the gaming portion of the show now. The release of a classic Xbox controller. It's called the Duke.
This is silly
something. And I love it. tell us, Russell.
So the original Xbox game console had this controller that was just massive. It was this, compared to the controllers that we use today for pretty much any kind of gaming, they were just a big, messy piece of plastic that had great big buttons all over the place. And it was very affectionately referred to by the Xbox team at Microsoft as the Duke controller. And it was very quickly replaced with slimmer, smaller controllers. Microsoft, there are some really impressive TED Talks and stuff about the amount of work that Microsoft has done to kind of streamline controllers to make them more ergonomic and to make them feel better so that you can actually use them for longer and not, you know, your hands don't get tired after a certain period of time. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of people, nostalgic, I guess. We have just a massive nostalgia ride in our culture right now,
mm-hmm.
that loves that great big controller. And so this other company, not Microsoft, has been working with Microsoft to bring it back and to make it more modern. So it's being made for the Xbox One X. And it actually has its own special display built into the controller where the original Xbox medallion used to be. So it's got some additional features to give you some additional data when you're playing different kinds of games or to just, you know, be fancy and have your name on it on the display. But it looks and feels very much like this original Duke controller for the Xbox, which I personally hated. but a lot of people really, really love. So I can appreciate, you know, the desire to have this controller. For me, it's this big, heavy mess, and I don't enjoy using it. But it is very cool to see how much work went into bringing this controller back for people who love it.
Well, they brought it back and they improved it.
They brought it back and they improved it, yes. It's designed to work with the Xbox One X, so it has a few more buttons than the original Xbox controller. It has all of the same kind of button accuracy things that the new Xbox One X controllers have, so it's not quite as clumsy as the originals.
Mm-hmm.
And surprisingly, given that it has a display in it and it's got all this fancy new stuff in it, it's only going to be $70 when it's available, I think, at the end of this month.
Sounds like they can sell it to the masses at that price.
Yeah, that seems to be the goal, is to get as many people interested in it as possible. I'm reminded of just how entertaining a reaction people had to the original Duke controller. There was actually a company called Mad Catz who made these mini controllers that could like fit in the palm of your hand, that had all of the same buttons on them, almost to make fun of the Duke controller, because they were small enough that it was like a 5-year-old could use this controller and have all of the same kind of button reach that most people had.
Now, it'll work with all current games.
Oh, yes. This will, you know, you plug it in and it works exactly the same way that any normal Xbox One X controller will.
Are there any particular games, though, that people who want this controller back or the facsimile of the original back are particularly eager to use it with? Are there old games that people never seem the same with the new controllers?
Microsoft has done a lot of work over the last year to make it so that a lot of the older Xbox games will play on the Xbox One X. Make it so that if you had an original copy of the original Halo game and stuff like that, that you'd be able to play it well. And so I suspect that there will be people who will feel comfortable enough to go back to some of these original games, Perfect Dark Zero and things like that, and play in those environments. But ultimately, and this may be a little biased on my perspective, just because I don't actually enjoy this controller, but it didn't feel terribly different, from using one or the other.
Are there any games that it would negatively impact?
Games where you are relying on just kind of how quickly you can reach some of the buttons. If you're reaching farther because the controller is bigger, then it could end up being a downside. It really just depends on how comfortable you are holding the controller and how big your hands are.
Okay. Gotcha. Like the piano.
Right.
Last week, news broke that Amazon Echo devices were laughing for no apparent reason. And I'm glad I didn't know about this. Ours so far has not laughed. What's going on?
There is something truly special about coming home and finding your partner with a hammer. Saying that if Alexa laughs, I'm going to shatter it. And mine did not. But it was kind of a funny 24-hour period where there were people who were, kind of figuring this out all at once. What Amazon says happened is that there used to be this command where you could say, Alexa, laugh. And Alexa would just start laughing. And so there was this misunderstanding where people were having conversations near an Echo, and the Echo heard something that it thought sounded very similar to Alexa laugh, and so would just kind of start laughing maniacally. Because that was a joke that was put in when the Echo was first released, and not something that a lot of people knew about. But because of just the violently negative response to this supposed accident, Amazon has gone through and changed the phrase to Alexa, can you laugh? And instead of just responding with laughter, Alexa will now respond with sure, I can laugh, and then demonstrate the same laughter as before.
Wow. Was it pretty widespread? It just started happening?
I think what happened, this happens a lot with the internet. I think that this happened in a couple of places and someone got it on video.
Okay.
And so a lot of other people tried to figure out how to make it happen on theirs as well. And so it spread like that. You get that a lot with these AI speakers. Someone figures out kind of a weird trick and it creeps people out for a while. And so they try it themselves and it just makes it worse. So I think that was probably what happened here. I doubt very highly that Alexa was just laughing in a room where there was nothing there to activate it. The Alexa microphones are very capable. They have seven pretty significantly powerful microphones in there that can hear you from across, multiple rooms.
Yeah, it's nice.
And so that I think what happened in a lot of these cases is the Alexa service just mistook something else that was said for the laugh command and did that laugh. But yes, under no uncertain circumstances would I say that is definitely a creepy thing to have happen.
Whoa. One time my phone, I had a YouTube video going on my phone and I turned it off. I thought I turned it off, but I'd only paused it and it started turning on again, and it was down in the basement and I about had a heart attack that someone was down in my basement talking. And I couldn't understand.
That's so funny. Yeah, I think
it's so sad.
Thing that's ever happened I have very similar lines. I think the weirdest thing that's ever happened to me was I was listening to an ebook and I had paused it, and then something. I think my son hugged me or something and nudged the button on my headphones.
Uh-huh.
That had turned it back on, and the headphones were on the other side of the room, but it was just enough that I could hear someone whispering.
Yeah. Right. Creepy. Creepy bull. That just gives me the creeps. But anyways, Russell Holly, thank you so much for joining us today. I always appreciate your help.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.